I'm John Kroll. Today on No Limits, as part of our ongoing conversation about the health of Hoosiers, we're going to take an extended look at the federal budget proposed by President Donald Trump, and specifically at the changes it would make in health care. We'll discuss how these changes would affect Hoosiers. My guests are Mark Fairchild of Covering Kids and Families and former Indiana Representative David Orentlicker, a medical doctor and a constitutional law professor. Please join the conversation. Call 866-476-3881. Email nolimits at WFYI.org. Find us on Facebook at NoLimitsWFYI or track us down on Twitter at WFYI. Now, this news. Welcome to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StateHouseFile.com, and your host. We're going to be talking about how the changing healthcare landscape will affect Hoosiers, particularly those in lower income brackets. We're going to be talking, obviously, about the changes to the Affordable Care Act or proposed changes, both the House version and the proposed budget from President Donald Trump. If you want to join the conversation, you can do so by calling us at 866-476-3881. You can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi or on Twitter at WFYI. My guests are two veterans of the program. Mark Fairchild, he's director of public policy for Covering Kids and Families, and the Renaissance man of Indiana, physician, attorney, former state representative David Orentlicker. Welcome back to both of you.
It's great to be here. Thank you.
It's good to have you both here. And I should say that this show was produced in partnership with WFYI's health news initiative, Side Effects Public Media. It's part of our ongoing conversation about the importance of health for all Hoosiers. So I'm going to start. I'll start with you, Mark. It's important to emphasize that none of these proposed changes are actually law yet, that they're not there. But we probably ought to talk about what the scope of the of what is being proposed. First, why don't we start with what the House passed? What was it, about 3 weeks? The rush of events is so great that it's hard to believe it was only 3 weeks ago. But
Right. Yeah. And I appreciate you putting that asterisk on things, because we've definitely gotten signs that the Senate plans on doing something quite different, or at least that's been the public statements there. But certainly this is a very sweeping group of changes they proposed. And these go in three separate categories. We're looking at the health insurance marketplace, which is largely for those individual enrollees that are above the Medicaid expansion cap. So we're looking at above 138% of the federal poverty level. But then also changes are going to be impacting the group in between that are using things like the Healthy Indiana Plan. That's the Medicaid expansion group. And then a whole nother group of changes that are impacting core Medicaid programs for those under 100% of the poverty level. So we're really looking at major changes to all of them. That large Medicaid group, switching it over from more of a reimbursement based system to a per capita cap system, which basically means there's a fixed amount the federal government will pay, and then the remainder will fall upon the state. We look at that that middle group, the Medicaid expansion group. Largest change coming there that was proposed is to take the enhanced match, which is additional dollars beyond what was in place before for expansion type programs, that basically makes it so Indiana can do more novel things and offer a better payment system for providers to be on the Healthy Indiana Plan and get that network more robust. That would be fading away as well. And then, of course, with the marketplace, which is the core area where probably most of the consumer complaints actually came from, we're looking at changing the payment system, where we'd be getting those advanced tax credits that would allow you to afford buying that insurance up front. They'll turn into more of a refund-based system. That's probably going to be smaller for our low-income folks and our folks that are in the 50-plus category, that they'll be getting less assistance than they were traditionally getting. And then, of course, the stuff we've heard more publicly talking about, things like essential health benefits, that states can waive those. and looking at community ratings, more commonly known as pre-existing conditions coverage, where pre-existing conditions, you wouldn't necessarily be declined for having one of those costly pre-existing conditions. You can look at everything from diabetes to forms of cancer, but your insurance rate could go up substantially, and you could look at being placed into a high-risk pool.
So, David, the assumption, and it's easy to get lost in the details here, is that the plan that came out of the House was sort of the Republican response, but there's some significant differences between what the House adopted, and we're not even going to get to the Senate yet, and what the president has proposed as part of his budget. Could you detail some of those?
Yeah. Well, the budget doesn't go into as much detail. There are Medicaid. Both of them want to cut Medicaid. And as Mark said, one of the important features of Medicaid is it's what we call an entitlement. If you meet the eligibility criteria, if you're a pregnant woman, if you're a child, if you're disabled and you're poor, and now under the Medicaid expansion, if you earn less than 138% of federal poverty, if you meet the criteria, you're poor or other factors, you get coverage. No more questions asked. And the budget has to meet whoever has the need. What the Republicans in the House want to do and what the budget wants to do is say, we're not going to guarantee coverage to everybody who meets the eligibility criteria. We're going to set a fixed amount of money. And if it's not enough to cover everybody, then we won't cover everybody, or we'll reduce the benefits that we provide. And that's a huge change. And what we know is for the parts of when we have, there are programs for disabled individuals which have operated that way, and you end up with long waiting lists. And it's not a good way to run a program. It's also, we've had that sort of the original HIP 1.0 versus HIP 2.0. HIP 1.0, there was a limited amount of money, and we'll whoever we can cover with this limited amount, we will. HIP 2.0 covers everybody, and that's a big difference. And I guess from a broader perspective, what I would say about these proposals is what the Affordable Care Act, what it did in large part was to say there are a lot of holes in our safety net for health care. There are a lot of poor people who don't get health care. There are a lot of people with heart disease or cancer or diabetes, the pre-existing conditions, persons who can't get insurance. These were the holes in our safety net, and the Affordable Care Act patched those holes and gave us a more secure safety net. And now these proposals would undo the patching of the safety net and recreate the holes, put the people with pre-existing conditions back at risk, and put poor people back at risk. And that's a serious problem.
We've gotten an email question from a listener that's somewhat on point here. It's from our regular listener named Jerry. And I should say, if you want to join the conversation we're having about the changes in the healthcare landscape, you can do so by calling us at 866-476-3881. You also can email us at nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi or on Twitter at WFYI. Jerry wrote us and said, as a nation, Americans currently appear unable to agree about whether health care is a right for everybody or only for those who can afford to pay for it. For the purpose of preserving civilization at a local level, what do the panelists think is the minimum standard of health care that must be available to everybody, regardless of ability to pay? David, I'll start with you first on that one, but I'd like to hear Mark's thoughts as well.
Well, Jerry is right. We do need to view it as a right and that everybody should have. But this is one of the hardest questions in healthcare. How do we define what is part of that right? You know, healthcare is so much different from, I use the analogies of housing and food stamps because it's much easier to define if we want to give people housing, how many square feet and how many, you know, what kind of facilities. It doesn't break your budget. Feeding people doesn't break your budget, but some people need millions of dollars of health care. Some people need none. And so trying to get at what is a minimum decent amount, and places that have tried have had a lot of problems. So we can define categories. We can say you ought to be able to go to the doctor. We ought to, if you need to go to the hospital, if you need lab tests, if you need preventive screening, dental care. So we can come up with categories of care, but trying to define what is essential, and what happens is when states have tried to do that, they often end up with more generous packages than what you and I get from our employer health insurance. So it is a difficult thing, but it's not impossible, and other countries have done it, and they've done it at far cheaper costs than we have. So there are not insurmountable obstacles. It's just you have to work hard at it, and fortunately we can turn to models in other countries to see how it's done.
Mark, your thoughts, what's the minimum?
Right. Well, and first I would like to say I think we are moving closer to really seeing healthcare as a fundamental right than we sometimes give ourselves credit for. While that does fall in the Affordable Care Act, because we got such a higher portion of our population insured, that they've gotten used to the benefit and they've gotten used to what that does for them overall. But the broader question of what are the core benefits, it's hard. It's certainly harder for us because we're in a market-based system. We're not doing a public option such as David talks about with some other countries mm-hmm. where they have that. Because there, they can simply say, well, we're going to cover this larger swath of packages, and you use it or you don't, and the cost to us is the same. In a private system, it's based more about the cost of your insurance is based on what you want to bundle into it, whether you use it or not. So it puts us in a much harder position. I think most would agree that the Essential Health Benefits Package under the Affordable Care Act was a really good start at trying to define everything that we want to make sure at a minimum is covered, and that we don't have things like capping coverage. I mm-hmm. think we've seen, as caps were mentioned in the media, that people reacted very harshly to that pretty quickly, saying, no, we don't want to get to a point where we're going to deny somebody something that's potentially life-saving. But the broader argument of, well, there's life-saving and then there's quality of life. Am I able to work, go about my day regularly, live pain-free? Where's that line at? Is something where Americans, now that we've started to see healthcare as more of something that we are all entitled to, now we need to decide amongst ourselves and say, well, what level of health is really right for us and best for us in the country?
So with these changes, as journalists, we're taught with anything like this to start asking the question, who benefits and who's hurt? With these proposed changes, we'll start with the first part of that. Who would benefit from these changes and these proposed changes? Mark, I'll start with you. David's smiling, so I know he's got an answer.
Right. And there's a couple of ways to look at it. Certainly, what was written into the plan and the discussion around it by the authors was that it will make plans more efficient and more affordable for the average American. That's something that's certainly yet to be seen how that would unfold, if that'd be true. We can say the way it's written would allow for some cheaper plans, but they would be plans with less benefits built into them. So going back to the question about why do we have things like essential health benefits, mm-hmm. because healthcare is not a predictable commodity of what you're going to use, how much you're going to use, when you're going to get sick, when you might have a disability or something like that come forward. So, yes, you can have a cheaper plan, but you're not going to know if it's actually more affordable for your overall healthcare cost until you start using it. So that's going to be a tough animal. Now, the other end is almost all of these are proposed cuts. There's not a lot of additional funding going directly into healthcare here. So there is a reality, and admittedly so, from those that are writing some of the bills, that they are looking at trying to fund their tax break package, which mm-hmm. they hope will, of course, again, help the average American, give them more money to spend on things more discretionarily on either health care or other needs that they have. But again, that's a speculative thing, and we can't really be sure until it would unfold.
David.
Yeah, the winners, there are a few categories. Wealthy Americans are big winners because they're going to reduce some of the surcharges that the higher Medicare payroll tax, the higher tax on investment income, those tax increases that were used to fund the Affordable Care Act are going to be rolled back. People who are healthy young Americans will be better off because they won't have to spend as much for insurance, and upper middle class Americans because subsidies to buy insurance will go high. It won't phase out as quickly. So if you're healthy, you don't have a pre-existing condition, you'll be better off. The medical device industry will be better off because the tax, another funding source for the Affordable Care Act, is going to be rolled back. So it's the people who are already winners in society are going to win even more under this program.
We are talking about how the changing healthcare landscape is affecting Hoosiers, particularly those in lower income brackets, today on No Limits. My guests are Mark Fairchild. He's director of public policy for Covering Kids and Families, and physician, attorney, former state representative David Orentlicker. I am John Kroll. You're listening to No Limits. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of thestatehousefile.com, and your host. We're talking today about how the changing healthcare landscape will affect Hoosiers, particularly those in lower income brackets. The show is produced in partnership with WFYI's Health News Initiative, Side Effects Public Media. My guests are Mark Fairchild. He's director of public policy for Covering Kids and Families, and lawyer, doctor, former state representative David Orentlicker. Before we went to the break, I asked who benefited from this. We're going to take the flip side of this. Who is likely to be hurt by these changes? Who are to use a term that our president is fond of, who are the losers here? David, I'll start with you.
Yeah, there are a lot of losers. Poor Americans are big losers because of the cutbacks in the Medicaid program. You know, one of the big changes with the Affordable Care Act is we no longer talked about deserving poor versus being poor. That under old Medicaid, it wasn't just enough to be poor. You had to be poor and disabled, poor and pregnant, poor and a caretaker of a child. Under the Affordable Care Act, simply being poor was enough. And that was an important change in our thinking. These changes would undo that, and poor Americans who aren't disabled or children or pregnant would lose their health care coverage. Older Americans, their subsidies will be based on age, but they won't make up for the fact that insurance premiums. So if you're an older American, you're less than 65, you're not in Medicare, you're going to have higher health care bills because of your age. You're going to have more to make up out of your own pocket. People with pre-existing conditions, the protections for people with heart disease, cancer, asthma, diabetes are going to be eliminated or could be eliminated under this act. Hospitals are going to be big losers. They're going to – one of the funding sources for the Affordable Care Act was cuts in Medicare reimbursement for hospitals. But they were supposed to make it up because they'd have more paying patients of the poor, fewer uninsured patients, more Medicaid-covered patients. If we cut back Medicaid, they still got to eat the cuts in Medicare reimbursement. They can't make it up in the Medicaid reimbursement. So a lot of hospitals, they already have thin margins. This may force some hospitals to close. Women who use Planned Parenthood. Mm-hmm. The bill's going to cut funding for Planned Parenthood. We already don't have funding for abortions. This is for primary care. This is for pap smears, for mammography, for treatment of sexually transmitted diseases. And a lot of women just get their basic primary care, Planned Parenthood. So women who use Planned Parenthood are losers. State governments are going to be losers. If, as Mark said earlier, if the federal funding is cut back for Medicaid, the states have to make up the difference. It's a federal-state partnership. And the Affordable Care Act said the federal government was going to pick up more of the cost of the covering the poor, and these proposals would undo that and put more pressure on state governments whose budgets are already stretched. And you know, Medicaid is a huge part of state budgets, and there's not a lot of room in many states, especially the states that have the highest population of poor people who need Medicaid.
Mark, was that a comprehensive list, or can you think of
that,
more?
That's pretty comprehensive, certainly, and I won't try to repeat everything David said, but I certainly concur with all of them. You know, in general, I'll pull it back a little bit and say, really, it's a loss to everyone, and particularly those that don't have a wonderful understanding of their insurance to begin with, whether we're looking at the marketplace, We're looking at some of those newly insured under the Healthy Indiana plan, because a lot of those folks don't really understand what they're losing under this. And that's one of the most concerning things. They're losing a lot of the subsidies involved. They're going to see a plan that's maybe $20 cheaper a month and go for it, thinking that they've saved money. They're not going to realize the situation that they're going to encounter when they walk into the emergency room and their state has waived that essential health benefit and they don't have some of the basic services that they would have expected from their insurance. And we know probably even those in this room don't always understand their insurance policy 100%. But there's some things we've come to expect that we don't necessarily naturally associate with the Affordable Care Act. So when we lose those, it's going to be quite surprising. I talk to consumers every day that say preventative care, for example, and some of those checkups you can get for free and some of those other services, they don't have a natural connection that that's from the Affordable Care Act. And that's a really troubling area by itself. Preventative care is the one thing that we all benefit from because it bends the cost curve for the consumer, for how they're using their health insurance, but also for the state, for the federal government, for everybody involved. Prevention is the only way to really pull those costs back down. And then going with that, the state's a loser, not just financially, but Indiana's got quite a history of not doing terribly well on negative health outcomes. We look at our tobacco use rates and some other things where we tend to rank very low. Early reports coming out this year through the CDC show Indiana actually has a lower uninsured rate for the first time than the rest of the country, and that we're shrinking that rate even faster than the rest of the country. We've got something that we can really hang our hat on that we haven't fixed all the other things, but if we get more people engaged in health care, we know we can work on those other things as they come. And now we really run the risk of that gain slipping away and putting us even further down when we were at our one chance to really move up as a state.
So go ahead, Dave.
Yeah, just to Mark's point about how we're all losers on the budget, there are some other things, cutbacks in research for NIH. So thinking about the long term, if we're investing less in research, we're going to have not as likely to figure out what's causing diseases and how to treat them, less funding for public health measures. If my biggest criticism of the Affordable Care Act was it was focused too much on treatment and not enough on prevention. And these reform proposals would cut back even more on that. What little there is for prevention and public health would be taken away. And that's a huge step backward.
So this is at the very least a fairly abrupt departure then from trying to think of neutral terms to frame this in. What problem is this trying to solve? I mean, what is the problem that moving away from the Affordable Care Act is trying to resolve? Mark, I'll start with you.
Right. And there's a couple of things that have been cited publicly as the largest issues. Most of them have focused around the marketplace and then about mandates. So we looked at the mandates it brought in for individuals needing to have insurance or facing those tax penalties for large employers to have to offer insurance to their employees. And then the essential health benefits were another form of mandate, what had to be an insurance package. And a lot of the discussion about that was related to the marketplace and how expensive marketplace plans were getting. And then if we pulled back and allowed some freedom, we didn't force people to buy insurance, that would lessen that individual cost and stabilize those markets. Now, the more troubling part is that's been the discussion, but it doesn't really clarify why we're touching the other programs, the larger Medicaid base, which in Indiana insures around 1 million individuals, why we're making cuts there. Why we're looking at some of those other programs that really aren't a part of that discussion. But for the average American, their understanding is the cost of those marketplace plans, those folks that felt they were being priced out of being able to have insurance, that we see those cases where they're talking about doubling or tripling their rate. That's really been the largest area that we've seen that they say they're addressing through this.
David, I'll reframe the question. Is this a solution in search of a problem?
Well, it's a solution that addresses a different problem. Mark is right about the problems, but the solutions really exacerbate the problems that we have with healthcare, and they're really designed for something else. So the problems about the marketplaces don't work as well as they should. And the biggest problem is not enough young, healthy people signing up. So the insurers underprojected, underestimated how much what the cost of insurance was. They underpriced. They've incurred losses. So the answer to that is to figure out how can we make sure that we have a broader pool of more healthy people buying insurance. All these proposals will do is discourage, will keep the young, healthy people out of the market. It will just increase the problems. There are other things they've done is, insurers need predictability, and they don't know what's coming mm-hmm. next. So a lot are going to back out because they don't know what kind of revenues they can expect, what kind of support from the government. What this is really about is cutting federal spending on health care. That's the Medicaid part, mm-hmm. right? Nobody's been complaining mm-hmm. about how Medicaid's operating, but the federal government needs more money. The House GOP and the administration want more money so they can fund their tax cuts. The Affordable Care Act was about improving our health care system. It also was about, I don't know if it was intentionally or just incidentally, but what it also did was counteract, decades worth of government policies, primarily tax policies, that shifted income to the wealthy and fueled our income inequality. And what the Affordable Care Act did was try to reverse some of that and create more equality, not full equality, but less inequality. And this is just going to take, when I said they were going to help the wealthy by reducing their fair share of healthcare spending and return the money to the wealthy in the form of tax cuts. That's what this is going to do. And that's what's really driving them, is so they can fund their tax proposals, which are just going to give us more income inequality and less equality.
What is the first, say these things, and again, we probably need to put out there, this isn't law yet. There's still a long and difficult process before it becomes the law, any of these proposals. But suppose that it were, what would be the first thing that people would notice about the way healthcare has changed in this country? Where would the first impact be felt? David, I'll start with you.
That's a good, important question, because for a lot of people, there might not be much of an impact. If you work for a large employer like Lilly or Cummins or Indiana University, you may not see much change. But if you have to buy insurance on your own, or if you work for a small employer that doesn't provide insurance, or even if you're a small employer who wants to provide insurance, if you have to buy insurance based on your health status rather than the average health status, those are the people that are going to find, once again, as it was before the Affordable Care Act, that they're going to be priced out of the health insurance market. And a lot of poor people who gain access, who never could get access before the Affordable Care Act and got access for the first time, are going to lose that access. So people on the margins, people who need help from the government, they're going to be the big losers. They're going to notice it. But as I say, for people who are in a large employer that has a large pool and of people they cover, and insurers have always been willing to insure at a good rate, they may not see much change.
Mark.
Right, absolutely. And it's important to note we're still looking at, when we talk about those under large employers might not notice the changes quickly, the remainder is still about 1.7 to 1.8 million in Indiana that are on Medicaid programs or the Healthy Indiana Plan or using the Marketplace. So it's still a very large swath, but two of those groups, the Marketplace folks and the Healthy Indiana Plan folks, are still very new to insurance. So if their plan simply gets tweaked or altered, they're in that pool where they're still just happy to have insurance. And we hate to see a system where that's the case, but that really is the case. And I worked with the Healthy Indiana Plan 1.0 when mm-hmm. that first came out, and it got capped at a very small number. And those folks were not in any position they felt to complain about their insurance. They were just happy to have it. So I don't think we'll see the complaints necessarily coming directly from that group. And yes, most folks are covered by large employers. Now, there's still some risk if you're with a large employer. You're not completely safe. Depending on the sector, there's plenty For large insurers, of course, that the largest benefit they offer is health care, and that's why people choose them, go to them. But we do have sectors that have more low-income workers, that have lesser benefits, things where we're looking to retail and warehousing and some other things that are fairly large around Indianapolis. They could see a change in their plan. But again, will that get attributed to these changes, or are they just going to see it as something their employer did? So that's the tough part. I think we'll see more of a slow and steady over the next 2 to 3 years, people realizing what they've lost, what isn't protected. Maybe they do start having where they have some lifetime and annual caps be able to sneak in, because that's an important point. Essential health benefits that we've been talking about, they're automatic benefits that are available, but they're also, if states start waiving those, lifetime and annual caps, those things that made it, so if you had a really expensive treatment, your insurance essentially stopped paying their share in a year or over a lifetime, those caps only are enforced, the inability to use caps is only enforced against essential health benefits. So if you're in a state that decides to waive some of the maternity care and you have a very high risk, high cost pregnancy, you may not realize it, but they could. The insurers could install again the right to put a cap there and say we're only going to pay for the first $100,000 of that. And that could be a really dangerous thing potentially for everybody.
We are talking about proposed changes in the healthcare landscape. If you want to join the conversation, you can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi, on Twitter at WFYI, or you can do what a listener named Audrey has done and give us a call at 866-476-3881. Audrey, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Certainly. What's on your mind?
Just a few comments. One, Blue Cross Blue Shield started out with some doctors in Texas because they wanted the families they served to put aside money so that they could afford to go to the doctor. Second thing, excuse me, I'm a research nurse, had a study. This 33-year-old black male, or female, goes to the hospital with severe leg pains. Now, she knew her mother had diabetes. She knew a sister had diabetes, but she had never been tested. Turns out she had diabetes, didn't know it. They were able to save her leg, but they didn't save her from going into sepsis. Her hospital bill turned out to be more than $1 million. I had to collect that sum as part of the study to show how expensive sepsis can be to treat. So prevention is really the thing. If she had had any kind of ability working as a waitress, she had no insurance, to think to go and get tested and get her condition under control. That's the whole thing. People need to be empowered to do what they can to help their own health. And, well, that's my comments for today. I'll listen to you after I go off, hang up.
Thanks very much for the call, Audrey. Mark.
Right, and exactly. That's two of the things that we were just talking about that are so, so important. Preventative care and proper prevention being the one thing that can keep people healthier up front and bend that cost curve, because the care that would have been needed even for a lifetime of diabetes care would have been under that ceiling of $1 million. And then looking at the potential that if they start calling that a pre-existing condition, how expensive could that treatment be or the insurance for that treatment be? Or if it did get to the point of sepsis still and caps are in place, that individual could be left on the hook for the vast majority of that $1 million bill. So two great points from that listener.
Yeah, and one other important point about what the Affordable Care Act was trying to do is under our old traditional kind of paying doctors, the more you did, the more you made. And you made more money treating somebody in septic shock if you're a doctor or a hospital than preventing the septic shock. And one of the things the Affordable Care Act is trying to drive toward is reimbursement systems that reward doctors and hospitals for keeping people healthy, not for treating them when they're sick.
Changing the incentives, basically.
Exactly.
So for that kind of care. We are talking about how proposed changes in the healthcare landscape will affect Hoosiers, particularly those in low-income brackets. My guests are Mark Fairchild, he's Director of Public Policy for Covering Kids and Families, and physician, attorney, and former State Representative David Orentlicker. This show is produced in partnership with WFYI's Health News Initiative Side Effects Public Media. I'm John Kroll. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Krall, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StateHouseFile.com, and your host. We're talking about how proposed changes in the healthcare landscape might affect Hoosiers, particularly those in lower income brackets. This show is part of an ongoing conversation that's been produced in partnership with WFYI's Health News Initiative, Side Effects Public Media. My guests are Mark Fairchild. He's director of public policy for Covering Kids and Families, and physician, lawyer, and former state representative David Orentlicker. We've got an email question from a listener named Ann. And again, if you want to join this conversation by email, you can send your email to nolimits@wfyi.org. Ann writes, the one thing that all single-payer health care does is have the government define what is covered and set health care costs. Some countries negotiate. Some say this is what we will pay, take it or leave it. But the kicker is that some countries still let the insurance companies provide the insurance. Think of Medigap, supplemental insurance for Medicare, as an example of how this might work. Could this be a hybrid that could bring Republicans and Democrats together? David, you're nodding your head.
Yeah, there are lots of ways you could do a mix of government and private sector and other countries. When you go, Switzerland is much more market-based than, say, England is. And the Netherlands is, you know, kind of in the middle. So that's absolutely right. And there are a couple things. You don't need to get rid of private health insurance companies to have universal health care. What's typical, some of the things she mentioned, two things that you tend to see in the other countries that retain insurance companies, and even our Medicare program uses insurance companies to help administer the program. But there are a couple things that you see in those other countries. One is their insurers are non-for-profit. They have other incentives to stay in business, but the profit motive is not one of them, and their overhead costs are much lower than here. And the second thing that's important is, as the caller mentioned, the negotiation of prices, that there, whether or not the government is paying or you've got insurers paying, what happens is every year there's what's called an all-payer negotiation. All the insurers come together with the government and they set prices for everybody. And when the government exercises its leverage, it can get much lower costs. And when economists talk about why are our health care costs higher than in other countries, that's the most important reason, is that we just pay more for the same service. An MRI that might cost $1,000 in the United States can cost $100 in Japan, and it's a great MRI, great quality. But the Japanese government is a tougher negotiator, and we don't use our leverage. And in fact, federal law prohibits HHS from using its negotiating power. So there are ways. It wouldn't mean that these companies go out of business. There would still be an important role, just as there is in the Medicare program. But, you know, Republicans and Democrats, we don't seem to see enough effort to find middle ground on this issue as with other issues.
I'm going to ask, and normally I was giving both of you a crack, but we're starting to get calls, Facebook and all of that. I'm going to try to move through as many of them as I can. We've got a comment from a listener named Robert via Facebook. And again, you can find us on Facebook at No Limits WFYI. Robert writes, the World Health Organization studied healthcare systems around the world, and based on access, outcomes, and affordability, the U.S. system ranked 36th best in the world. France was number one. Now, I'm not sure, but I'm guessing we're number 36 is not a chant we want to brag. Mark, response?
Well, yes, that's certainly true. I think we can all agree on that. And a lot of that has to do still with the kind of system we operate under. We're trying to make that transition from healthcare being a commodity to a right in our country, and we talked about that earlier, because that's what really changes that national conversation about how we can ensure that everybody is taken care of, everybody has some essential level of care there. But it's very difficult because we still see it as a commodity, because even if we move into a hybrid-based system, we know that our system is so based on a private model that the public partnership is going to have limited control to how we can bring that cost down. Now, one example of moving towards something more universal, absolutely, that brings the cost down. You have talk about larger pool, well, everybody's the pool, instead of just those that are really sure they're going to need insurance, which is unfortunately what the current plan that they're looking at pushing through is likely to bring about. Those that figure they don't need insurance won't get insurance, and the sicker are those that just have more of a prevention mindset will. It's going to be more costly, which makes it less accessible, which means even some unhealthy people or those that really need preventative care will opt to not have insurance.
We are talking about possible changes in the healthcare landscape and how they might affect Hoosiers here on No Limits. If you want to join the conversation, you can do what a listener named Lewis has done and give us a call at 866-476-3881. Lewis, welcome to the program.
Thank you. I would like to know why H.R. 676 is not getting more publicity in the press in the discussion with healthcare. It's an enhanced single-payer system sponsored by John Conyers, and it now has, oh, last time I looked, 112 co-sponsors, including Andre Carson and Pete Bisposky. And it seems like what we're being led here is this binary choice between continuing Obamacare or the new Trump care. And there is there's a third way to go here with the enhanced Medicare. I don't really have, in a sense, a dog in that race because I'm a veteran and I'm also retired. So I can go to the VA hospital. But I really, this whole idea of insurance companies determining whether or not you're going to get health care or not, and whether you can pay for it out of pocket, it's, to me, just rubbish.
Thanks very much for the call and the comment, Lewis. But I'm going to let David, as the former politician on the panel here, explain why that might not be getting the traction or attention.
Yeah, I assume it's a Medicare for all kind of proposal, single payer proposal, and those have just, we've seen historically, very difficult to politically to pass. I remember President Obama saying, if we were starting on a clean slate, single payer, but we're not, and we have to start with where we are in our country and build on our current system, and single payer gets characterized as socialism. And even though we have a Medicare program, and people who get their health care through our Medicare program are very happy with it and nobody wants to get rid of it. Nevertheless, politically, it's difficult. I will say, tying this into the previous caller about, what about hybrids? What I say is that the Republicans should be saying not Medicare for all, but Medicare Advantage for all, because Medicare Advantage is the free market alternative. If you have a beneficiary of Medicare, instead of getting the traditional Medicare government reimbursement, you can get the government to pay your premium for a private health care plan. It's a voucher in effect. That sounds very Republican, and why not do Medicare Advantage for all? That's what the Republicans should be advocating if they really mean, as President Trump said, universal coverage, and if they want to retain a free market approach. That, I think, could work. The problem is that it costs a lot of money. It wouldn't cost more than it does now, but why don't we get there? Because it would show up in taxes rather than in deductions from people's salary. We pay it through our employer. We pay less through a payroll tax, but it would show up more visibly as a tax.
Gotten an email from a listener named Patrice, and again, our email address is nolimits@wfyi.org. Patrice writes, the talk about pre-existing seems to be always about active illnesses, cancer, diabetes, heart, and et cetera. I have had people tell me that it's fine as it is not fair to buy insurance after becoming sick. In 2008, as a healthy woman, taking no daily medications, I was denied insurance because of a pre-existing condition. This condition was having two colonoscopies with benign polyps in the last 5 years. Two companies denied me insurance, and one company would cover me at a high rate without my colon for 10 years. I was in this situation because my company declared bankruptcy and health insurance disappeared. Let's educate on what a pre-existing condition can be. Thank you for the program, Patrice. So, Mark, let's do that. How do we define pre-existing condition?
Well, and pre-existing condition, the traditional understanding, yes, we'll talk about things like diabetes, cancer care, other things like that. But she's absolutely right. They can be much broader. Because what we're really looking under this proposal is something in place that's called community ratings. That's what states are able to waive under one of the amendments to the new bill. Community ratings say that we can only increase the cost for an individual based on age or the cost of living in their area. If we remove that, it opens up a whole lot of other things we can base it on. Some of the talk has even been, boy, can we even look at just that you have risk factors, not that you're actively have a condition. Her example would be one of those to say, well, you've had this before, and we know there's a certain risk of it coming back, and it could be much more expensive for that. So it really goes beyond just that active disease, as she so nicely stated there, that it can be anything that puts you at risk. And this is even where the far-reaching stuff is even talked about. What could genetic testing and other things bring up? That's not been part of the direct conversation, but it's a much more open definition of pre-existing conditions than what most people are really picturing.
We've gotten a tweet from a listener named Coop, and again, you can track us down on Twitter at WFYI. Coop writes, book by Elizabeth Rosenthal, An American Sickness, says nonprofit hospitals are making obscene profit. The healthcare industry, hospitals, doctors, pharmaceuticals, medical devices, are robbing us. What are we doing about this, David?
Not so much. I mean, you know, it's not universal. There are plenty of hospitals that are struggling. But, other countries put, you know, do much more to contain pharmaceutical prices. That's why you hear all these proposals to let us get our drugs in Canada. It's a lot cheaper to get drugs in Canada or Europe than it is in the United States. And drug companies in Switzerland who are under tough price caps do very well. There is an argument, and it's hard to know how legitimate it is that the only reason why the drug companies can accept pay the lower reimbursement in other countries is because they make up the difference here. And if they couldn't make up the difference here, they'd have to cut back what they invest in research. It's hard to know because we know when people make arguments like that, it's not often backed up by data. But we do know it's clear that our government just doesn't do what other governments do to limit healthcare spending and healthcare reimbursement. It gets back to the problem that I mentioned earlier, is that our prices are higher across the board, whether it's a surgery, whether it's a drug, whether it's a medical device. We pay more for the same quality that people in other countries do. And that's why people with means will go overseas for their elective surgeries. If you need a hip replacement, you can do it for a quarter of the cost and get very good quality care in many other countries.
I've gotten an email from a listener named Elizabeth who writes, and again, our email address is nolimits@wfyi.org. Elizabeth writes, what are the specific fixes for the Affordable Care Act, and why don't the Democrats focus share them so the public can advocate for a fix? Mark, I'll start with you, but I do want to hear, as a former Democratic state legislator, I want to hear David's thoughts as well.
Right, absolutely. And first, again, nobody here is trying to state that the Affordable Care Act was without flaws or any problems or difficulties. That's certainly not the case. It was designed to be fixed over time. We look at Medicaid, which has taken, you know, decades to get to its efficient form that we see today. And it's not an easy one to answer, but we know, for example, on the marketplace, it was based on a simple flaw that our young, healthy people would join. They didn't put enough incentive on that. They didn't make the pool diverse enough. The penalties that they put out, the tax penalties that were installed, did a couple of things. One, they weren't high enough that they were more expensive than getting insurance, so it was still a savings to not bother doing that. And they still did rely on what's called a disincentive system. We'll punish you for not doing it instead of incentivize you for doing it. And that's some things that would need to come into place, is how do we incentivize healthy behaviors, including having health care coverage in the first place? And that's something that really needs to be brought forward a lot more.
David.
Yeah, I think there are a few things at work in this. Why aren't the Democrats advocating more? Partly because they've seen it's not very it can be futile. If you can recall, President Obama spent a lot of time trying to entice Senator Grassley and other more moderate Republicans to work out a bipartisan proposal, and they spent a good part of a year. And it ultimately, the Republicans, like Senator Grassley, pulled back and decided that they politically it wasn't worthwhile for them to try to come up with a bipartisan proposal. Second, it's hard to get agreement within your caucus. The Republicans are finding that now. There's the Freedom Caucus, there are the moderates, and where do they end up? And, you know, even when the Democrats had 60 votes before Senator Kennedy died and they had their filibuster-proof majority, there were some very conservative senators like Senator Nelson from Nebraska who saw things very differently from some of the senators like Chuck Schumer. So trying to find a common ground. And then I think the third factor is the politics of it. You know, Democrats want to regain the majority, and if they can let the Republicans fail and not be very effective at governing, then it will make voters more likely to vote Democrats back into the majority. So that's another part. Just as the Republicans ended up not cooperating with President Obama, Democrats are not inclined to cooperate with President Trump and their colleagues in the House and Senate.
What are the chances that these proposals actually do become law? We sort of closed, the listener opened the door by talking about the politics. We've emphasized that, that they aren't law yet, that they, you know, the House version has passed one chamber, but it seems to be pretty much dead on arrival. And on the Senate side, what is the likelihood, Mark?
Well, the likelihood that this exact form of legislation goes through is very, very low. I won't say zero, but I'd say it's certainly nothing that's going to be untouched. It'll be more about what philosophies from that bill continue on and what's that going to look like. Now, we saw a large public response to essential health benefits being at risk, the creation of high-risk pools, pre-existing conditions maybe losing their coverage. I think the public reacted very, very quickly to that. So it's going to be – those are going to be less of a negotiation point now, where they're going to have to go back and say, okay, that's something we have to find a way to say we're not touching it in the way you think that we are. The bigger question is probably going to be what's happened to Medicaid and can they continue making those changes, knowing that the average American is very detached to what the difference of per capita block grant funding and reimbursement-based funding are going to be. So I could see that still going through in somewhat its current form.
David, in about 10 seconds, how big an issue is this going to be going into the election season next year?
Right now, it looks like a huge issue when you see what happens at these town halls. It's easy to think back to 2010 when the Tea Party used the Affordable Care Act to mount in a huge wave. So as things look now, this could be we could see a wave in the other direction.
I'd like to thank my guests, Mark Fairchild and David Orentlicker, for a provocative and lively conversation, and our listeners for some great questions. I'm John Kroll. You've been listening to No Limits. Thank you for joining us.
No Limits is a production of 90.1 WFYI Public Radio, Indianapolis. Producer, Shannon Cagle. Interactive Media Coordinator, Scott McAllister. Technical Producers, Cedric Freeman and Chris Flood. And Board Engineer, Joe Hatcher. No Limits is made available through IPBS, Indiana's public broadcasting stations.